I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Senator Ben Cardin has represented Maryland constituents in Annapolis and Washington for more than 50 years. He is running for his third term in the U.S. Senate against a Libertarian, a Republican, and an Independent. From the ACA to the environment to active duty troops at the southern border, the president's assertions about changing constitutional provisions for birthright citizenship, and his rhetoric that many contend has led to deadly violence, what does advise and consent mean in the age of Trump? Has the Senate become a different deliberative body than it used to be? Ben Cardin joins me to make his case for another term. Plus, we go back to the garden with Denzel Mitchell and Carrie Engel. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. Another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Senator Ben Cardin. Senator Cardin has been a fixture in Maryland politics since 1967, when he was first elected to the Maryland House of Delegates. He served as the Speaker of the House for 8 years, the youngest person in Maryland history to hold that position. He was elected to Congress in 1987, and 20 years later, he was elected to the United States Senate. Senator Cardin is the ranking member of the Senate Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee. He is a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and also a member of the Environment and Public Works and Finance Committees. Ben Cardin is a lifelong Marylander who calls himself a proud graduate of Baltimore City Public Schools. He is 75 years old. He and his wife, Myrna, have a daughter and two granddaughters. Mr. Cardin faces three opponents in this election: Republican Tony Campbell, Libertarian Arvin Vora, and Independent Neil Simon. You are welcome to join our conversation with Senator Cardin at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Senator, always a pleasure, sir. Good to see you.
Tom, it's really a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for making time available.
And I know you have a busy schedule today, so we don't get you for the whole hour, but we're delighted to have you now. Talk to the voter. Who is that voter who is present in every election, the voter who is looking for change, the voter who says, you know, we've just got to do something different. The way things are going, it's just not the right way. Obviously, we had a big change election in 2008 when President Obama was elected. We had a big change election in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected. But for that voter who says, you know, Mr. Cardin, he's been in office for 50-plus years in Maryland and in Washington, but it's time for change.
Sure. Well, elections matter. Look what happened in the last election. We got Donald Trump as president of the United States. I would suggest that we need a strong Congress as a check and balance on this president, and that you need an independent voice that will speak out for American values and fight for policies that are important to the quality of life of people, good schools, less expensive higher education, protecting our health care advancements so that we have a stronger health care system, a less expensive health care system, not go back to how it was before the Affordable Care Act was passed. We want to protect our environment. I'm proud of the progress we've made on the Chesapeake Bay, the federal partnership. The president wanted to end that program. I was able to get the Congress not only to fully fund the federal partnership in the Chesapeake Bay, but to our committee's recommended an increased federal share. Also did the programs that will allow our port expansion was done on the water bill that was just signed by President Trump. So in this environment, I've been able to get things done that are important to the quality of life of Marylanders. I'm not happy with the direction of this country under President Trump, but I do believe that Congress needs to be an independent branch to stand strong. And when the president says things that are wrong, I'll be there to speak out and act out. And will always be willing to work across party line to get things done. I think that's what Marylanders want in this environment.
You are a student of history, and in particular, a student of the Senate itself. As we saw during the hearings that ended up with the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, there was a huge breach in the body politic, and particularly in the Senate, not just the Judiciary Committee, but the Senate as a whole. There have been many people quite critical of your Republican colleagues in the Senate for not standing up to President Trump in other areas. But this division, this polarity in American politics really came to the fore of people's consciousness during the Kavanaugh hearings. Is this the time now for reaching across the aisle and being bipartisan, or is this the time now for the Democratic Party to dig in its heels and say, you know, no more of this?
Well, for the next few days, we're going to be extremely partisan because I want to get as many like-minded people elected as possible in the midterm elections. But once the elections are over, it's time to govern. You have to work across party line to get things done. You mentioned the Supreme Court nominee, Justice Kavanaugh. That situation was started by the Republican leadership in the Senate when they broke all historic precedent and denied President Obama Merrick Garland's consideration for the opening on the Supreme Court. It was outrageous. It was an affront to the United States Senate and to the separation of powers and allowing the president's nominee to be considered. They doubled down on it with President Trump when he selected a nominee out of a list given to him by groups that have an extreme agenda, the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, and did not open it up for a broader consideration. That's never been done before. So I hope that the way that the Supreme Court nominee was filled is not going to be the new norm. The new norm should be for us to listen to each other, work together, get things done. Fight hard election time to get our people elected. Afterwards, let's sit down, work across party line, and let's govern and deal with the problems.
Whether the Senate changes hands and whether or not Majority Leader McConnell remains the majority leader seems to be an open question. There's a lot of people thinking about that. There are many people who think there's a very good chance that Congress will flip, that Congresswoman Pelosi will once again be the Speaker of the House. If that happens, if Congress flips and becomes a Democratic majority and the Senate stays a Republican majority, what can you expect what can voters expect to have happen in the 2 years between now and the next presidential election?
Well, one thing we've seen under President Trump is he's tried to take over the legislative branch of government and the judicial branch of government. We see that by his appointments to the court. We just saw this week where the president said he's going to change the Constitution and change the way that we deal with immigration. It's important that we have an independent Congress, whether it's controlled by Democrats or Republicans. Our framers of our Constitution envisioned the check and balances of the legislative branch and the executive branch of governments and the judicial branch. So if the House were to flip, I think with the gavel being given to the Democrats, you're going to see that when the president does things that are just outrageous, and this Republican leadership has allowed him to get away with that without congressional oversight, I think you're going to see oversight hearings. You're going to see action taken in the House to counter the president from the point of view when he exceeds his authority or does things that are against the values of this country. The Senate is a little bit different. The Senate, because the normal relationship requires a supermajority to do our normal business, normally there's more comedy in the Senate. So it's important who has the gavel because the majority leader determines the agenda of the Senate. So it's very important, and we are hopeful that we'll see a change in the midterm elections and the Democrats will take that back. I would acknowledge that it's more likely the House than the Senate. It does make a difference on the agenda of the Congress itself.
Let me ask you about a local story that just broke yesterday. The University of Maryland Board of Regents made a very controversial decision to show Wallace Lowe the door as the president of the university, and they are retaining the coach of the football team and the head of the athletic department. This is the athletic department that's been described in both media reports and in reports commissioned by the Board of Regents as a department in complete disarray. And, of course, it led to the very tragic death of a young man, Jordan McNair, last May. Your comments about the Board of Regents' decision?
Tom, I quite frankly don't understand it. I don't understand how the coach is retained and the president is basically asked to leave. It just defies the logic of what we've heard over the last 6 months. So I'm troubled by it. And I would hope that we would get a more transparent process by the Board of Regents, because quite frankly, I'm very troubled by the decision.
The Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, which was the scene of such a horrible mass shooting, the capacity of the government. I know that this is an incident that hits very close to home for you. You and your family have been members of Beth Tefillah congregation here in Baltimore for generations. The capacity of the government to keep people safe in public spaces like houses of worship, like schools, like you know, public spaces of all kinds, rock concerts in Las Vegas. What can be done in this political climate to move the needle to make the United States a safer place?
Well, Tom, the attack in Pittsburgh was an attack on all of us, but it did hit home to me as having deep roots in the Maryland Jewish community, but also I was a student at the University of Maryland, and Squirrel Hill was my faith support community, so I know Squirrel Hill very well. So it does hit home. It's very personal. People went to a house of prayer as a sanctuary, invaded by someone who murdered them solely because of their religion. That should have no place anywhere in the world, and it recalls some of the worst moments in the history of mankind. What government has a responsibility to do, our leaders need to lead. That means they lead by their actions, their words, and their deeds. Words have consequences, and it's important that we don't encourage hate in our community. Hate should have no place in any community.
Has the president been doing just that?
Well, I think the president's language is inappropriate. I've said that over a period of time, and it is important that our leaders, by their examples, including their language, make it clear there will be no oxygen for hate. We saw what happened after Charlottesville. There was a rise of anti-Semitism, a rise of hate in America. When we look at the statistics on anti-Semitic activities, they've grown dramatically in the last 2 years. We need to understand that leaders are looked upon to show that there will be no space for that type of activity in the community. And when we don't choose our words properly, it can give space for hate. We just saw in regards to how we characterize different people, whether they're journalists, whether they're immigrants, whether they're people of a certain religion or a certain race, it has consequences.
It's the president having that kind of rhetoric out in the public square. It's the president's supporters who are backing up that rhetoric. We've heard people on Fox News talking about people in the caravan in Honduras bringing leprosy and diseases that haven't even existed for 50 years, you know, across the border. I mean, it's that kind of hateful, bigoted rhetoric. When the president has the kind of bully pulpit that he does, and in fact the president is himself a bully, what's the role of the Senate here? I mean, advise and consent is, it seems to me, to be a very different thing now than it was even 10 years ago. It seems that the Republicans in the Senate are just very reluctant to say anything too strongly against this president.
Well, I first of all, as a senator, we should speak out. We use our voice. We use our opportunities that we have to get public attention, to let the community know that there is no room for hate and that speech is wrong. And then by our actions. I'll give you one example. We should have passed well before Pittsburgh a ban on the private ownership of assault weapons. We should have passed the universal background checks. The students of Parkland asked us to do that a long time ago. We should have gotten it done. What we saw at Sandy Hook. And we've had these tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and the Congress has not taken up sensible gun safety legislation.
Any prospect of that happening then in the next 2 years?
I think with the gavels changing, the answer is yes. Absolutely. The overwhelming majority, I think it's over 90% of Americans agree on universal background checks. And I believe it's about 2 out of every 3 agree on the elimination of these assault style weapons and large magazines, these types of things, capacities. There's things that we could get done that are sensible gun safety legislation. We need to help provide the security to what are otherwise targets in our community for potential violence. There are things that Senate can do and must do through our actions, but we also need by our words to condemn when we see hate speech, when we see misinformation about vulnerable people. You know, if you're picking on any minority, every minority is at risk.
You've been in the Senate for a dozen years. There's a narrative that says the Republicans know that Mr. Trump is a bully. They know that he's a bigot. They know that he's often ill-informed or sometimes just blatantly uninformed. And they sort of acknowledge that privately. They're not acknowledging it publicly. But they're acknowledging it privately and going along with it because they like tax cuts. They like deregulation. They like the court appointments. They like, you know, the laundry list that we've heard about, and perhaps even many of them are sort of tough on immigration, the way Mr. Trump tries to portray himself. Is that true? I mean, you talk to these folks, you work with these folks, you work with Republicans as well as Democrats. Is that a valid assessment?
There's no question in my mind that many Republicans disagree with what President Trump does, both his language and his actions, and are very meek in standing up to President Trump. Mainly, I think, because they don't want to be attacked by President Trump. They saw what Senator Corker did, and a Republican from Tennessee, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. By the way, a real friend of the Trump administration during its early days on foreign policy issues. When Senator Corker started to be critical of what the president was doing in regards to Russia or what he's doing in regards to some of the other foreign policy mistakes that the president was making, all of a sudden, Senator Corker became a target. And he was bullied by the president of the United States.
Into retiring.
His chances of winning re-election were very much weakened.
Same thing with Senator Flake in Arizona.
When Senator Flake defended Senator McCain and defended, attacked the president for a lot of his rhetoric, which was inflammatory, we saw that he became a target. And Senator Flake's ability to win re-election was diminished greatly. So, unfortunately, we see that the senators, the Republican senators, appear to be worried that the president will pick them, each of them, as a target and make it much more difficult for them to be able to win re-election. Quite frankly, when we're dealing with these fundamental principles, it's our responsibility to speak out, whether it's a Democratic president, a Republican president, regardless of our party. That's what the framers of our Constitution envisioned the United States Senate and senators to do.
We have a comment, speaking of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, from Omed on Facebook. He says, will the Senate Foreign Relations Committee investigate the extrajudicial killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia? And what about sanctions on Saudi Arabia's government?
Absolutely. And we've already started that conversation. The Senate's in recess because of the midterms. But I've had conversations with both Democratic and Republican members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I am quite confident that we're going to take action. The president, at a news conference, said that he would yield to the Congress for recommendations on sanctions. We've already recommended what we call the Magnitsky sanctions, which are individual sanctions for those who are responsible, denying them the opportunity to have the visit America or to use our banking system. We're also going to be taking a look at arms sales. We're going to be taking a look at the U.S. role in Yemen. There are several issues that we will be taking a look at. I fully expect that this Congress will take actions against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as a result of this tragedy.
And do you think that that's – what will that accomplish? I mean, what's the end goal here? What's the aspiration here?
Make it clear.
Should the Crown Prince be asked to or be pressured to step down?
If the Crown Prince is expecting to gain international acceptability as a leader, that type of conduct cannot happen. So there's going to be, I think, it won't just be the United States. I think other countries will join us in these sanctions, and it may affect the Crown Prince's future in the kingdom. That's very possible. But it will certainly, we think, alter the calculations of future activities in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Ben Cardin is my guest. He's the senior senator from Maryland. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Senator, let's go to another email from Adam, who says, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm losing hope in our party. I watched the Republicans so successfully advance their agenda without reaching across party lines, without wanting a bipartisan solution, yet we Democrats continue to try to get along with them. Why should we continue to strive for bipartisanship when their efforts at partisan solutions continue to pay dividends for them while our efforts are unsuccessful? This is a sentiment we hear from a lot of Democrats. Right. They're just wondering, the party seems to be adrift.
Well, first, I would take issue with that. This is a very tough environment for Democrats. The Republicans control the White House. They control the House and the Senate. Yet look at the budget that passed this year, and you're going to see Democratic priorities were advanced. I already mentioned Chesapeake Bay. The president tried to zero it out. The full funding's in the budget. I could talk about NIH, where the president's budget was not favorable towards science and research. We not only maintained the budget, we got it increased. The president just recently signed a water bill that I helped craft that will provide additional funding to protect our water systems for safe drinking water and to dealing with wastewater that helps the Chesapeake Bay. The president wanted to affect our ability to deal with our harbors. And we changed that. So we've been able to stand up working with Republicans to get some good things done. Our foreign policy in this country has, we've blocked a lot of the bad things that the president tried to do. He wanted to eliminate all the sanctions against Russia. We increased the sanctions against Russia. So we can give you chapter and verse. Is it too partisan? Are Republicans acting too partisan? Absolutely. Look what they did with this tax bill. It was outrageous. Outrageous. Look what they did with the court nominees. Outrageous. And should Democrats do the same? No. Democrats, if we have the opportunity to govern, if we get control of the House and Senate, we should set an agenda consistent with our policies to protect people in the workplace, to clean up our environment, to make education a top priority, sensible gun safety legislation. Absolutely, this should be our agenda. But then we should work with Republicans to get it done so we can not only pass it, but we can, it will stand the test of time. And let's work with them to build on the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is a great success. The number of uninsured in Maryland has dropped dramatically. We now have quality coverage, affordable coverage. We want to build on that. We want to protect pre-existing conditions protections and bring down the cost of prescription drugs. We're not going to be able to do that alone. We're going to need to help have the help of Republicans. And that's what Democrats should do.
The Affordable Care Act, speaking of that, open enrollment begins tomorrow, and it lasts for 6 weeks through the middle of December. The Republicans, of course, voted multiple times to end the Affordable Care Act completely. There are a lot of people trying to walk back their positions on pre-existing conditions, for example. But the president has vowed to continue to try to sort of attenuate it, sort of nickel and dime it this way, that way, I mean, rather than just sort of abolish the whole thing. Do you feel that the Democrats are well positioned to be able to block those attempts?
I think the American people are on our side on this issue. And yes, you're absolutely right. The president's done everything he can to sabotage the Affordable Care Act. He eliminated the individual accountability, didn't do the cost sharing, tried to sabotage the reinsurance program, shortened the enrollment periods, didn't provide the money for outreach so people understand what's involved in the Affordable Care Act, won't defend the Affordable Care Act's protection against pre-existing conditions, and the list goes on and on and on. Despite all that, the Affordable Care Act is still here. It provides the basic protection. And there are millions of people benefiting by having quality coverage. We now have coverage on pediatric dental. We have behavioral health. We have addiction. We have mental health services. All are now covered under the Affordable Care Act. We had our uninsured rates are at historic low levels, down to 6% in Maryland. That's a dramatic reduction in the number of uninsured. So the Affordable Care Act is working. The next chapter, let's protect the pre-existing conditions and the progress we made, and let's take on the pharmaceutical industry to bring down costs.
And let's go to the phone, Senator Mark in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Senator Cardin.
How you doing, Senator? I just want to first thank you so much on behalf of myself and the fellow constituents here in Maryland for all that you do on behalf of Maryland. I just had a quick question for the senator.
I'm with you.
The senator mentioned the inappropriate language that that our president has spoken, and it hurts. You see people getting hurt, unfortunately, in Pittsburgh. Just something, the state of affairs that we're in right now, it hurts to see leaders, as you mentioned, such as Louis Farrakhan, stating that I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm an anti-termite. How is it that we could have leaders not condemning that? We have leaders from the Democratic Party, I'm registered Democrat, we condemn the president. But then we have leaders that say such hurtful things and that really have an effect. But yet we see pictures of President Obama standing with Louis Farrakhan. It really hurts me as a Democrat to see that our party is not standing up to the hate, to the vile hate that we sometimes see. We stand up to President Trump, and I'm so happy for that.
Okay, Mark, well, thank you for that point. Thank you for that point. I appreciate it. We had a long discussion about this yesterday, about people making equivalencies between somebody like Farrakhan and the President of the United States.
Well, first of all, there's only one president in the United States. He is the leader of the free world. What he says has so much impact, not just in the United States, but around the world. So when you have a leader in the Philippines that does extrajudicial killings, that's killing people without any effort to know whether they're guilty of crimes or not, that person points to the president of the United States for legitimacy. Or you see Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, that has murdered so many of his own people, embraced by love with the President of the United States, that emboldens these types of despots around the world to carry out their actions. And you have to think that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia thought the President of the United States would support him in this effort to do in this journalist. So I don't disagree with the caller in that any form of discrimination against journalists, against Jews, against Muslims, against the LGBT community, any of this is outrageous and needs to be condemned, the language that's used. And so that's incumbent upon all of us, whether we're a senator or whether we're a journalist or whether we are a rabbi or whether we are a teacher or a student. We all need to speak out. But the President of the United States, the leader of the free world, what he says gets the biggest megaphone in the world. And his language has clearly given oxygen to hate. And there should be no oxygen date.
Because of the tax cuts passed last year, revenue is very much down in the federal government. Deficits projected to be over $1 trillion annually. Speaker McConnell or Leader McConnell has been on the record in the last couple of weeks saying that Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid need to be examined. What do you know about the plans for the Republicans to, assuming that they retain control of the Senate, what do you know about the plans to as they say, look at, in air quotes, these three programs?
Well, there's no surprises here. When the tax bill passed, we knew that it would add immediately $1.5 trillion to the national debt. Most of that relief went to the biggest corporations in America and the wealthiest people. The middle income tax cuts were temporary. If we extend that, that's another $0.5 trillion of debt in this country. The Republicans, in their budget document that brought us this tax bill, spelled out specifically that they wanted to cut Medicaid by $1 trillion and Medicare by $0.5 trillion. So what Leader McConnell, Republican leader, said that we now need to look at entitlements because they're causing the deficit. No, they're not causing the deficit. It was the tax cut that caused these large increases in the deficit. It's not a surprise to us because we do believe that they want to pay for this tax cut by cutting Medicare and Social Security and programs that are vital to our population. So we're going to defend that. We're optimistic we'll be able to block these cuts. Certainly this year we have. But in the future, these deficits, it puts programs like Medicare and Social Security right in the target for cuts.
Will Democrats be proposing legislation to rescind some of the tax cuts to increase the revenue?
I'm quite confident that we're going to look at modifying this tax bill, cutting back on some of the benefits that were given to the big corporations and the wealthy people in this country, looking for a more responsible way to help finance our budget. Look, we balanced the budget without any help from Republicans under President Clinton, and we did it the old-fashioned way. We did it by raising revenues, yes, and cutting expenses. That's the way you balance a budget. So we're going to have to look at where we're hemorrhaging revenues and where we can get it. We also need to look at revenues for transportation infrastructure in this country. And Republicans agree with us on that. We need an infrastructure bill in America to help rebuild our roads, our bridges, our transit systems, our water systems, our energy grids. So we need to do that. We need to have a revenue flow that will allow us to accomplish that. So Democrats will look at a responsible budget, not by raising taxes, but by looking at where we have people avoiding what they should be paying and looking at ways that we can make our healthcare system more affordable for all by bringing out costs like prescription drugs.
We got to let you go because you got a busy day this afternoon. But before I let you go, let me ask you to take a minute to sort of respond to this this feeling of desperation that Democrats seem to have. I mean, Donald Trump faced 16 opponents in the Republican primary, and he just sorted his way through all of them. And it seems like, you know, when the president starts talking about just insane things like, you know, executive orders ending birthright citizenship or a middle class tax cut by 10% in time for the election next week. This is just fantasy. It's just pandering. It's bringing pandering to a new level. But the Democrats don't seem to have a unified answer to counter this just sort of political silliness. What is it going to take for the Democrats to effectively counter these arguments that the president's making?
And first, let me put this in context. It's tough to get a message across when every day the president changes the storyline. You know, we don't know what he's going to say tomorrow. The day he did it by the immigration issue on birthright. So every day he changes the storylines, and the news outlets will chase whatever he is doing. So it's tough for us to get a message. Well, let me tell you what Democrats believe in. We believe first in the values of our country are our strength. So we're going to stand up for American values. So any attempt to marginalize people because of their religion or race or their ethnic background, we're going to fight that. We're going to wrap our principles into the policies that we support. I've mentioned education several times. We believe education is the great equalizer. So we want to invest in pre-K through 12, but also in post-secondary, which are trade schools and college. We believe that you should be able to attend a four-year college without going into debt. And we have programs that will accomplish that in a responsible way. We're already moving in that direction. We believe in the environment. Climate change is real. We have programs that where America can again assert its leadership. No, we think it's wrong to pull out of the international agreement. The only country in the world, U.S. should be the leader on climate change issues.
And we're going to have to leave it
there. And the list goes on and on and on.
The list does indeed go on. Incumbent Democratic Senator Ben Cardin is running for a third term in the United States Senate. Senator Cardin faces three opponents in this election: Republican Tony Campbell, Libertarian Arvin Vora, and Neil Simon, who's running as an independent. Early voting continues today and tomorrow from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. Election day is Tuesday. We'll have complete election coverage on election night right here on WIPR beginning at 8 o'clock. Senator, thank you, sir.
Tom, it's always a pleasure, and thanks again for making the time available.
Quick break, and when we return, we'll go back to the garden with Denzel Mitchell and Carrie Engel. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.